When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What if I told you that a cat meme could enlighten us on the existential threats our society fears the most?
What if I told you that by sending that eggplant emoji followed by three panting smiley faces, you're engaging in modern folklore? Hi, I'm Perry Carpenter.
And I'm Mason Amadeus.
And this is the Digital Folklore Podcast.
When most people think of folklore, they either assume that it just means old stories or they think of the Taylor Swift album.
In reality, it is so much more. Folklore encompasses nearly everything: the richness, the complexity, and the weirdness of human expression.
The internet allows communities to form, bloom, and flourish in ways that they never have before. And wherever people gather, folklore emerges.
From the absurd to the unsettling, we dig into the ways we express ourselves online and the artifacts we leave behind.
We consult with folklorists, journalists, academics, and of course, normal folks as well, to shed some light on how digital folklore holds up a mirror to our society.
And we're going to have a lot of fun doing it. Season 1 drops January 2023. Here's a peek. The fairy tale flies. The legend walks, knocks at your door. The one can draw freely out of the fullness of poetry. The other has almost the authority of history. Jacob Grimm, Teutonic Mythology, 1844.
Welcome. You've got
digital folklore.
The internet is a monster.
And he creeps through the house.
Oh my God.
This creepy chicken suicide enchantress.
There have to be more stories. There's not just one ghost.
It became something of the internet.
Folk horror and hauntology, I think they've actually got a lot in common.
Slenderman is the least scary thing about this case.
Be sure to subscribe to or follow the Digital Folklore Podcast so you don't miss anything that we have coming up. We'll see you soon.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Folklore Podcast. I'm Mark Norman, folklore researcher and author. Today, we're returning to the universe of the Rubicon Films Sideworld series with their second episode, Terrors of the Sea. Director George Popoff and writer-producer Jonathan Russell began their work under the Rubicon name with two narrative feature films, Hex and The Droving. The Sideworld series grew out of that work, but they shifted to the documentary format to tell these stories. The series investigates otherworldly tales and the people who inhabit them, and speculates on the deeper meaning of mankind's role in dealing with the paranormal. This film explores supernatural occurrences at sea and on shores, where frightening or unnatural things have spilled over onto the land. The feature examines four main themes: ghost ships, which we've covered on the Folklore Podcast before, sea monsters, spectral sailors, and mermaids, another past episode subject. Both well-known and more obscure stories are told, and tales of disaster dominate much of the film. Ships run aground, drownings, monstrous attacks and sabotage can, as the film puts it, open up a gateway that allows two worlds to collide. The film beckons you toward that gateway, to peer into the side world. Past guest of the podcast, director George Popoff, recently rejoined film and theatre correspondent Tracy Nicholas to discuss Terrors of the Sea.
For thousands of years, since man first sailed the waves, the vast open ocean has been a gateway to the unknown in unexplored regions of the world. Can man and sea ever truly coexist in harmony? And what terrible fates await creatures venturing from both sides into each other's cruel and unforgiving territories? Between fact and fiction is enshrouded in mist and shadow. Beyond that threshold is a place that can change our perspective on everything we think we know. I call this place the Sideworld.
So here today with George Popoff, who is the director of the Sideworld series. And today we're going to be taking a look at the second film in the series, Terrors of the Sea. And so, George, thank you for being here. I really appreciate it and looking forward to having a chat with you.
No, thanks for having me. Absolutely. It's great to be back and to talk to you now. So.
So this is the second, and you spoke with Mark about the first one. But the series now, you've done a lot of fiction before. And so now, you know, moving into the documentary, I'd love to hear a little bit about you and how you kind of made that journey to do this new kind of film.
Yes, of course. I mean, me and Jonathan, who's the writer for most of the stuff we do, and we wrote the two narrative films together, and he now writes the Sideworld films. We own a little production company called Rubicon Films, and yeah, we've made two feature narrative films called Hex and the Droving. One came out 2017, the other one came out 2020. And then we have also multiple other narrative projects that we're still working on. So that's still a big part of our journey. But we also felt that, you know, both of those films were, you know, pretty much in the folk horror genre, right, as you can say. And we're both interested in all the stories and legends, and especially when the blend of genres, of not just looking at history in one way, or horror stories, or folklore, or fairy tales. What happens in modern day, how does that relate to what happened before? We love to bring all those together. So the idea of having a documentary series where we can come at all these angles and kind of bring all the fans of each one of those subjects together under one hub seemed quite exciting for us, because that's usually the type of language and excitement we had between, you know, each other. So and we had a lot of little stories that we've heard and legends and everything that we were always interested into possibly turning into feature films. But we also have our original stuff. And if we had to make every single one of those stories we're interested into a feature film, there is not enough years in a lifetime to do that. So it seemed like, and some of them were just not worthy of a 90-minute, you know, treatment like a feature film. So it seemed quite exciting to us that maybe we can put some of them under a theme, and then do a series of documentaries that we can then provide to the fans of, like I said, all these different interests that we all have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that you know, it's interesting. So each one of the episodes kind of focuses on a different area, but it must be really hard, even, you know, with having multiple stories that you can address. How do you sort of narrow down and figure out which stories are gonna, you know, be interesting, and which, you know, do they have to work together in a certain way? How do you pick those?
You know, that's a very good question. I mean, right at the beginning, there was the first when we were thinking of okay, we want to make this into a series, something longstanding, keep making it as many as we can, and like, because we're interested in it. But as soon as we thought of what the first few, the subject matter could be, in the order of them, We were worried, okay, are we going to have enough? And it took about 5 minutes to answer that question and pose the next one, which is, though, oh no, that's not the problem. The problem is, which ones do you pick?
Right.
So you're absolutely right. It's I think with especially the first one, because with the examples of Haunted Forests of Inland and now with Terrors of the Sea, you know that you're going to have plenty of stories to look into. And with the example with the forest, that was more regional to particular locations. That's how the film was chaptured. You know, you had the Wiseman's Woods, you had Epping Forest, you had Cannock Chase. So that gave us the option of just picking out the best stories out of those forests, and only few of those were left on the cutting room floor in a way, because there was that great centralization around the locations themselves. But we had to cut out some potential forests that we said, well, if people like this documentary, and it was the first Sidewalled anything, if we continue well, maybe down the line we will make Haunted Forests of England 2 or Haunted Forests of somewhere else, where we can then bring all the other forests that we wanted to address. Now, with Terrors was more complicated in a way, because we decided to not just restrict it to the specific locations, but kind of open the chapters to the subject matter and kind of, like, as you call it, the almost the subgenres of nautical horror fairy tales and legends and paranormal events, where we go into, you know, ghost ships and monsters and everything. And there's so many of those. So which ones do you address?
Right.
So that was a multi-purpose answer to that one, because you had to combine the idea of, yeah, some of them will be to places that we know they're going to have a bit of a local vibe to them. And we're still just playing within, you know, we're still starting. So we're playing within our UK kind of sandpit almost.
Right.
And then that helped a little bit. And also, yeah, when you come up with the theme of the film and when you structure it, just some stories structure in different ways. So the narrative background helps a lot, because I don't really look at them too much from my point of view as a director as the ways that probably a proper documentarian, as I would say, would look at it. And I leave a lot of that to Jonathan when he writes it. But like, my job at the beginning with the stories is just like, can we actually have like a narrative flow that people be interested in the same way that they do in a fictional film, rather than being in class listening to the information. I want to see, like, at what point are we just kind of introducing everybody to the world? Maybe then, you know, it takes a darker turn. Maybe you have another story that changes then the period, a different tone. Which story will allow me to use what colors at what point? Stuff like that, that I would usually think that way when we're making a narrative.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for a documentary, and I've noticed this in both films, that you really do come from a storyteller perspective. But I think that it's interesting that whereas so many documentaries that try to do that just become really over the top melodramatic. And you don't. There's a really nice balance in there of sort of having those interesting stories that draw you in, but not, you know, having, you know, the
reenactment bit, and then you have the, yeah, you know,
exactly, yeah,
exactly. Absolutely.
Now, you did just mention the colors that you use, and that's sort of a nice lead-in to talk a little bit about the cinematography. And I've noticed in this film, it seemed like a lot of the colors that you use, there's a lot of black and white, but a lot of the colors you used were cooler colors. And I was wondering if that was just really a nature of what you were filming, or if you're trying to evoke something with that.
I think one of the reasons why we picked Terrors of the Sea to be the second one after Forests was the fact that it will provide a different color palette. Mm. And I know it sounds like a bit simplistic, but I just didn't want to address another green subject matter right away, because, like I said, in this first year of what we're doing, our idea was to let's introduce people to what this Sidewalled thing can be, because they don't know about it yet. When you make one film, it's just, that's the film. Haunted Forest of England is one entity. Then you make two, they'd be like, oh, there's two. When you make three, now it looks like it can be your horror documentary franchise. So I really, really wanted to start with something that gives you a bit more of a palette. So of course, with forests, you know, there's no point of turning the whole film pink. You know, if you're provided with such great green patterns and everything, and the whole world of what you're photographing, you're of course we're extracting the most out of it, and we're helping it in post production. But it's mainly us playing with, as we said it like in joking, almost our actors that were a bit wooden. You know, like, because I wanted to see what the trees are giving us and then help it a little bit. You know, for example, Wiseman's Woodsworth kind of had this slightly turquoise color to it. So we only helped that without changing it. But they did provide a greater palette to the film overall. Same thing with Terrors. There are still nuances. There are still moments that, you know, the color shifts. But I really wanted to have that initial feel of you know where you are, and he helps you set the atmosphere. And when the color does shift and we go for a bit of red because the story got more violent or something, then it's so much more effective than if you are kind of all over the place lacking that centralization of color.
Right. I also noticed that it was parts of the when you were filming the water, parts of it seemed off and like, you know, kind of had you a little bit on edge. And I thought, is that in reverse? Is the water?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
And that was, you know, it was really cool because it absolutely gave me that effect of feeling off balance and feeling like something was not, you know, normal.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. We had some shots and some moments, and that's something that Terrors helped us even understand what we can do more with our format. And how we can push it in a way that you will still feel comfortable to people, but at the same time, we're kind of try to break a little bit of boundaries what the documentary can do and how atmospheric or how poetic and how engaging it can get, contrary to some other examples. And we started playing with, I mean, you mentioned black and white as well. That was something new that we introduced in this one that we didn't have in the previous one, where a shot will start in color, but then will end up in black and white or vice versa, depending on if that's really good with the works with the story. Because I found that narratively, we have so many moments when we're coming from what's supposed to be back in the day fiction and storytelling to the more modern experiences of what people then they saw. So it really seemed like an interesting idea to cross that boundary within the same shot, rather than always that be something that you just cut to. And same thing with the water. Yeah, sometimes if we wanted it more creepy, it will be slowed down and reversed, and or made more different color as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that because you have a series of different stories, having to have those transitions, I think that that's really well done, because you need, you know, like in the transitions that you provide, you know, there's a little bit of time to sort of finish digesting the story that we just heard, and then like get ready for the next one. And so those shots are a really great way to just help the pacing of the film, I felt.
No, 100%, absolutely. It's even when we were thinking about the subject matter, I got so excited when we were gonna do it and said, okay, we're deciding that's gonna be the second one, aside from other options. And then immediately I felt like, what am I filming? Water? Like it's like, I mean, with trees, it's different. I know. I mean, with Hex, that was a film that was set in the forest. That was kind of like my training on the job to like know how to build up atmosphere, so I felt comfortable with that. But when we got to the sea, I'm thinking we can't just shoot the sea for an hour and 20 minutes, and it's not really gonna work. So we of course used a lot more, and that's why you have all the shipwrecks and everything and all the other stuff. But even when you see the waves, because you kind of have to have that as well, you had to feel that belonged within that particular chapter, which made that you couldn't have everything that you like about the sea in the same chapter. Because, for example, you know, we really bet on using the whole kind of like mist package of our shots on the first ghost ship section, because it felt like that was the image of a ghost ship coming out of the mist and then disappearing into the mist was very important. But that means that later on we use that a little bit less. Same thing with when we're talking about the spectral sailors section, which were very kind of like heightened romantic stories, very 19th century feeling. And it was about people wrecking their ships and surviving and or not surviving. It started on a big storm with those. With those romantic paintings, you know, yeah. Obviously coming into light. So that means that we can't use too much storm stuff in the other one. So you kind of had to pick and choose to make each section feel fresh and new, aside from just the same thing over and over again.
Well, and I think part of what was interesting about it, about the different sections, you know, as you're saying earlier, you with the forests, it was, you know, we're going to stick to this geographic area because, I mean, you know, ghosts, spirits, creepy things is just, you know, so monstrously big that you have to pick something. With this, it seems like, you know, again, you know, the oceans, the sea is huge. So it was when you broke it down into the different kinds of terrors, that really added a lot of interest for me because first, you know, when you start describing ghost ships and it's, you know, is it a apparition of a ship or is it a ship that, you know, inexplicably is just the crew is gone. And it was interesting to see the different kinds of, you know, like it wouldn't have occurred to me. I think of a ghost ship, you know, I'm thinking of an apparition, but it's like, oh yeah, there are these other things out there.
No, absolutely. It seemed like the sea, topic. It had so many clear, like I said earlier, kind of almost like subgenres within its folklore that it felt like we should address that within the chapters rather than say like, well, these are stories from Kent and these are stories from Cornwall. And these are like, instead of doing that, cause like obviously with forests, it was mainly ghosts and, you know, some cryptid, some interesting stuff that you can, but it was all about what that specific story is in that specific forest, where exactly.
Right.
Where with the sea, you really felt like, at least with the first time with you, Terrors, again, we'll probably come back to it again. It seemed like we wanted to start and kind of give an opening chapter to all of these subgenres and kind of pocket them that way.
Wasn't that a little bit of the difference between land and sea? I mean, you know, people historically are like, we own this land.
Oh,
but
yeah.
The sea is, it's, well, I hate to make this joke, but it's more fluid. And so, you know, you can be near land, but it's, you know, it's not owned by, you know, considered to be owned by people in the same way. So the stories are more mobile in that, you know, just because a ship is from England, it doesn't mean it's not going to be, you know, by Australia or what have you.
Absolutely.
I think it's interesting. And I think that, you know, it's interesting the kinds of stories that are a little universal that happen in multiple locations. And I think when you were talking about like the sea monsters, you know, that those were coming up. There were a lot of similar kinds of stories about huge sea serpents in different spots.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in the future, when we open up the scale to be outside of just the UK, hopefully, you know, we get to that point. it's still going to be on some topics. It's still going to be fluid. Like you're going to have some core of the stories because we want to go somewhere and shoot. And I think that's what we want to get the local vibe of the place. And I think that's what distinguishes a lot of our cinematic approach to some other documentaries, that we're not just looking for the image that's going to serve that particular sentence in the script. So you just see what I'm saying.
Right.
For us, that seemed not very exciting and, you know, not really the way we make our other films. So it was about like, no, let's go to what's going to be really relevant visually, tell the story visually. Mm-hmm. And then the narration is just there. So you don't get bored almost. And so, you know, the context of what you're seeing. So I think when we go to the States and we do, let's say a Terror of the Sea American version, the core of the stories will probably originate from, you know, Boston or Lake Michigan or wherever you want, or off the coast of Florida, in terms of what monster, what ship, what thing it is. But of course, they will travel, like you said, because it's a more fluid subject matter, but with a definable core of the atmosphere and the sort of the folklore of the people.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's interesting too of the different cultures. So you know, if you were to come to America, it's you know, because you've gone you know at many different points in time, and I think that was part of what was interesting about this, even following particular stories over time, and I want to ask you about that. But yeah, I mean, you've got Native American mythology, and
absolutely,
you know, you've gotten like travelers from all over the place, and then you've got you know. South America and Central America and North America, and it's all, there's, you know, big differences. And so it's, you know, it definitely is, again, trying to pick all the stories is going to be one of the hardest parts for you, I think.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So yeah, I did want to ask you, there, you did a story about the Goodwin Sands, where there was a ghost ship that comes back every 50 years.
Yes.
So it sort of ended with, you know, is it going to come back? You know, when will it come back again? But there was an expected date when it was supposed to come back where it didn't. So do you have any theories about why that happened suddenly after multiple recurrences?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I mean, obviously there is the most obvious theory that, you know, all of this has been just coincidences and hearsay and legends and storytelling, and some people lied or some people misidentified stuff, or very, very big coincidences and so on and so forth. Of course, that's option with everything paranormal, we talk about it, and it's like this story might be true, the next one might not be, you know. That's why we don't really focus too much on that, and we let people make up their mind. But what I think it's more likely, especially in this case, because there's quite a lot of proof of that this has been happening over and over again,
right,
is, and that's something that we kind of address more as a theory in our upcoming next one that we haven't really announced yet. But I'll say this, that sometimes when you see events replay again and again, especially when it comes to ghosts or specters or some sort of energy that seems to just provide an image from something that happened long ago, it seems like that, yeah, you might have a particular period from when that repetition happens, like in the case of the Lady Lovey Bond appearing again and again, but also some other conditions need to be right. Sometimes it's the weather, sometimes it's kind of the stars need to align, and I don't mean that from an astrology point of view,
yeah,
which
yeah.
I mean, it might be, I don't know, but as a metaphor, I'm using it. But I probably think like maybe there was something that just wasn't right with the conditions that kind of helps that image or that energy to replay once more. You know, not everywhere you go, when you shout, you hear an echo, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes you just need to have the perfect alignment of what the situation in the environment is.
Right.
To really get that replaying to happen. So that's, you know, I'm still only two or three of these in. So like we're kind of piecing it together. Sometimes you start seeing the dots connect, but I think that's one of my theories, but it could be anything, right?
Well, I thought it was interesting.
Maybe it was just shy, you know, too many people watching. Yeah.
That's true. I did think it was interesting. You sort of hinted at maybe some greater malevolent power with the Lady Lovey Bond. And you know, you're right. Maybe it's just the expectation that everybody brings that, you know, in this day and age, maybe when they came back and it was a no-show, it's because a lot of skeptics showed up that time, you know?
Yeah. It's possible. And there's you could have the opposite misidentifying as well, where it just like it comes back again, but it's just like, oh, that's clearly like an old ship. That's not it. You know, like
yeah.
you can have anything happen, but yeah, who knows? But that's why I'm always interested to hear, like, it seems kind of sometimes provide just the opening conversation to then people say, like, actually, I do have a pretty good theory, or I know more about that story. And I'm always excited about that.
Yeah, I'm a little more curious about why there's so much skepticism around like some of the sea monsters. They found some of them. They, you know, like washed up on shore. And I mean, the, you know, Loch Ness monster is eternally being debated. I mean, I just read right before we got on, I read that there have been 5 sightings this year. Including a film, you know, very short little snippet, but and still there people are just like, nah,
it's impossible to win it, because the moment when they say like, well, no sea monsters exist. And you're like, well, what about the giant squid that was proven to exist? You know, that was a fairy tale. Now it's just, but that's a giant squid. That's not the monster. It's like, yeah, but we were calling it a monster literally, you know, 50 years ago. So the moment when something gets identified is not called a monster anymore. So you can't win that argument. Do right. monsters exist there? Not because they keep just giving them the proper name, which right. is what science should be, you know. And then they say, well, there's no monsters. That was legit. It's like, well, it wasn't before. So
well, and isn't that true about like everything kind of magical and supernatural?
Yeah.
You know, when we didn't know that, you know, germs existed, illness was oh, yeah. considered, you know, humors or, you know, curses or whatever. And
absolutely.
So yeah,
it's just semantics at this point, and it's that's why from both sides I'm not a huge fan of the science versus mysticism conversation, because to me, and that's I guess why we called it side world, you know, that it's like there's that one you know, one time, one element, one place where those things combine, and for a split second they're both equally the same thing, and when one transitions into the other, so there's you know, to me they're part of the same, two sides of the same coin, really.
Well, and I think that particularly in that chapter of the film, when as you were kind of wrapping up each of the monster stories, it really did highlight for me who is the monster, because, you know, the people in the stories were sometimes pretty horrible.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. I mean, it's. Again, it highlights quite a few things, and especially the sea, as you said earlier, it's such a good example, because it's for us is like we fall in love with it, and but then at the same time it's so alien and hazardous and dangerous that we kind of we have this violent abusive relationship with it.
And
it just shows that when people don't know something, especially thankfully more back in the day than now, and hopefully we're trending in the right direction. You know, knock wood. People tend to react in a more jumpy, ignorant fashion to something that's weird and it's strange. And if we just had the moment to identify it or learn it or study it, and, you know, no one is saying if you get attacked by a shark, you know, make sure you cuddle with it, don't fight back. Obviously not. But at the same time, when you have the opportunity to understand and learn about something or you know, address it with grace rather than with just immediate violence, then there's more hope for all of us dealing with each other.
Well, I think too that you know, as we get as our technology advances and we have access to places that we would have never had access to before, you know, you're probably having people going to those new unexplored places, like deeper and deeper in the ocean and things like that. They're probably more educated people.
Yeah.
Because that's, you know, they got to a place where they could, you know, build the, you know, the stuff we need to get lower. And so, you know, they're people that are, focused on discovering rather than, you know, something washes up on shore and,
absolutely.
You know, the villagers show up and decide, you know, what kind of sign from God it is, you know? So hopefully, I don't know if we're getting any less superstitious.
Well, people are just getting, like you said, people are overall, people are getting more educated. So I think that's what helps. Like the more we lower the ignorance in the world, I think we will lower the evil in the world as well. I mean, a lot of us evil acts come from just pure mixture of stupidity and ignorance. And I think we're getting better at that as a whole. So I think that's the reason why maybe to this day, if something washes up, even on the shore of a small, you know, quite remote village, I think those people will have like a better idea of maybe how this should be approached.
Yeah, and certainly not to take the fun out of, you know, mysterious things and things.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, because that's part of, you know, the joy of watching something like this is hearing these stories and hearing, you know, how they're interpreted and even what they mean for us.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so can we talk a little bit about the score? Because I thought it was a really, you know, much as the, you know, cinematography, it was a really great balance between the music and the ocean sounds and different ship sounds. How do you develop that? How do you make that work with the film?
Well, starts with a great composer. So I've been working with Matthew Lemming. Now we worked together first on The Droving, and that worked really well, and we wanted to work more. And I just felt like when we went into the Sadwell projects that he'll be brilliant for that. The way he incorporates real sounds of an environment and how he can, you know, put texture in the film. And even when I was looking for someone for The Droving, at that point I was kind of gaining a little bit more confidence with being able to craft an atmosphere, and I thought like maybe we can make that thicker, maybe we can make that more tactile with the picture, with the sound, with everything, with the music. And he is someone who absolutely adds that atmosphere, that feeling, that texture within his music. And you know, we had a great run on Forest, and I think he had even more fun on this one, because he goes and records a lot of the score at actual shipwrecks.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
He did it all off the coast of like Ireland, and there was a shipwreck in the background. He had his mics and he was playing through his like keyboard, and so yeah, he's that kind of guy that he goes really within the atmosphere of the piece, and me being someone that's tries to push that even more so from everyone involved, trying to make this more than kind of surprise people. Then this is not your daddy's documentary where you're going to have some talking heads and blah, blah, blah. But you're going to get everything that you're there for in terms of knowledge and interest, but also you're going to really get submerged. Now I'm the one with the puns. You're really going to get submerged in the atmosphere and yeah, feel it from all sides, from the cinematography, from the music, from the storytelling, colors, imagery, artwork, all of that stuff.
Yeah, I thought when you're talking about the artwork, the imagery, I love the artwork. That must have taken a ton of research to sort of find really great images. And obviously a lot of it is outside, so you're getting, you know, the sounds of, you know, the sea and the visuals. There were a couple of interior scenes that had, you know, there was a, I don't know, cobwebby kind of. Are those places that you find, that like a pub that has that decor, or do you set up sets for those parts?
So the actual, the most interior we have in the actual Shipwright's Arms, where the story about that particular ghost, the ghost of Jack Tar the sailor, mm-hmm, is. So it was important for us to go and shoot there, okay, to really give that vibe. Now, if we were a normal ghost documentary, where it just goes there and we do the you want to check for ghosts, and nothing against them, I'm a big fan. I'm just saying that there is a lot of that and we're trying to be different.
Right.
You know, that's what the, you know, Most Haunted, whatever, or Zach Bagans, you know, they go there, they knock on the wall and it's like, ghost, can you hear me? I'm shouting at you, whatever. That's great. And it's all about that sort of visceral, you know, kind of found footagey, is it going to happen? What are we going to hear? Experience. Right. But obviously it's kind of counterintuitive to what we're trying to do, to be a bit more kind of storytelling and in the atmosphere. So when we go with those stories, sometimes we say, okay, that's a great story. We can go and shoot at exactly the place where it happened, but it doesn't look particularly great. And we have to really bend over backwards to make it look, to have the right vibe, to make this into our kind of more atmospheric, more artistic visual approach. But the Shipwright's Arms not only had the story of Jack Tar the sailor, but it really had this kind of remote vibe. And then inside, he had those, you know, all the nautical themes were inside the little pub as well. So it felt like we need to go there and shoot it. Like, we're not going to lose anything. And it's also going to be the double whammy of being the place where all of that happens.
Right.
That was really helpful.
Yeah, I'm really relieved to hear that, because I would have been kind of disappointed if it had just been, you know, a set that you guys dressed up, because it really did transport me. And I felt like, you know, I was back in the day where it happened, because everything,
yeah,
you know, it didn't seem here and now. So I'm glad to hear that.
No, thanks. We try to, like, sometimes if we are staging some shots for to just make things more filmy, you know, to make them feel more cinematic. We try to do that either for kind of little transitional pieces in between stories, or kind of just to help kind of like the stories round them up in a great visual way, or if there's no way of going to the place where the story took place, or it's underwater, or it's somewhere like really long ago, doesn't exist anymore, some, you know, like a castle that you don't even have the ruins anymore, so we shoot at another one. Right. Only in this cases, but yeah, to us it's important to go and really feel the vibe of the place, and sometimes can get challenging where you go there and you're like, well, it would have been better if we went somewhere else. But that's when, you know, me and Richard and the whole camera team, that's when we are kind of try to earn our stripes to be like, how can we extract cinematic, good cinematic language out of something that maybe it does look a bit more trivial, but so far I think we've managed.
Yeah, when you were talking earlier about the possibility of filming, you know, in America, I live a half a mile from Lake Michigan, and you know, there's a bunch of shipwrecks that are here, and you know, we've got a lighthouse in my town, and but you go there, and you know, there's buildings there, and there's Northwestern University, and so I'm trying to think of where you could go that it would even feel, you know,
we'll be fine. Like we've managed to squeeze so many of the shots you see on one side, there's like a hospital, on the other side there is a bin, and then, you know, like we're really squeezing in between a lot of angles to kind of make it work. So that's part of the fun, really, and I like that challenge, because anyone can just go and shoot like wide shot of pretty things, but we're trying to kind of like extract what's a good angle, you
know? Yeah, I never felt like I saw anything modern at all. Like I always felt like I was off on some, you know, windswept cliff.
That comes with sometimes with a lot of waiting, because you're on one hill and then you film your shot and then someone's walking their dog and you're waiting for them to just come out exactly in the, because we don't have the manpower yet to block off the whole beach, so for one shot, so we just have to kind of sometimes, I presume, like nature documentaries, like you're just waiting for the lizard to come towards the camera and you're just kind of standing there, and now we're just waiting for the person to get out of the camera, so you know, it's a similar mentality, I think.
Interesting. And of course, then you have to do it at the right time of day for your lighting.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's got to be nerve-wracking.
Everything was always on purpose. It's supposed to look that great. It never happened completely by chance. And we were incredibly lucky. No, we're just that good. So yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you a terrible question now.
Please.
Out of all of the stories in the film, do you have a personal favorite?
A much milder version of Sophie's Choice. All right. I'll probably kind of give a couple because they have a different, there are different parts of me that I can say, you know.
So you're saying you can't pick your favorite child?
I can't. Maybe I will in the process of answering this. Maybe.
Okay.
From a purely sort of my paranormal X-Filesy side, you know, being a fan of that kind of stuff from since a kid, I would say that the one with the submarine I really like, because we haven't done that much World War I, World War II period stuff until then, and that seemed like it had like a lot of pretty great proof, and kind of the film changes a bit and it goes into that style, it sends you back into that period, going into the accounts that the Germans said to the British when they got captured about what happened to their submarine and how they're attacked by a monster. Like that seemed like a breath of fresh air from some of the more usual periody, more medieval stuff. So I quite like that, and I think it's a pretty legit story if the event actually happened the way that they're describing it, which seems like it did. What they said about what happened is hard to argue with. From a point of view of then kind of more just as me being the one who directed the film, and we did everything in terms of to have a one sort of continuous theme going throughout. There is a reason why we put the Wild Men of Warford merman story right at the end, because it really seemed like a good example of that duality between men and sea that we were trying to describe throughout the film. And just as a character and as an image, he felt like he was the bridge between those two worlds. And again, he had that theme about who was the real monster, how people treated him. And even that was not very clear, because they fed him and they took care of him. They let him run, but then they tortured him as well, because that just seems like it's the medieval thing to do, the medieval welcome. So it just seemed like he had everything to it. And I think, and we had... we have the artwork that we research for that obviously makes a lot of the book of the documentary. But just like we did with Haunted Forest, on this one also we commissioned some original artwork as well, which was so that drawing of the Wild Man of Orford, the merman kind of holding to that net underwater. I love that one, and it just really, I think everything kind of comes together thematically in that story.
I did notice that that image of the wild man behind the net was very similar to an image from the pub where the man was.
That's the other piece of artwork. So so that's all done by a gentleman who happens to be my father, but also happens to be a great artist. And unfortunately, I didn't inherit any of that, so I can't draw. But he can, which is good. And I have the incredible luck of having someone so talented, so convenient that we can have that shorthand of in terms of what went. So, we had four pieces of original artwork for Haunted Forests. And then we had two more for Terrors of the Sea. And we're going to have that being as much as we can as a recurring element in Sideworld Films. And we're planning to open those to people to be able to own some of them as well.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I loved those two pieces, particularly because of the juxtaposition of, you know, it sort of looked like a jail kind of cell or a trap.
Yeah.
And absolutely. One was someone being kept out and one was someone being, you know, captured and pulled in.
Absolutely.
And so those, and it was, you know, as soon as I saw the second one, I was like, oh, wow, that's amazing that you have that. And so I loved that very much.
No, great, thank you. And he was very proud of them as well, and he really enjoyed doing them. So working on the ones for the next film. So
definitely tell him they were striking, because
I will. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, can you let us know where people can access your films, both Sideworld and your other projects?
Yeah, so Sideworld, Haunted Forests, and Terrors of the Sea should now be available. I mean, they're both been available on Amazon Prime for a while. Mm-hmm. I believe it's rent and buy there. But in the US, there's more choices.
Okay.
For your audience, which is also on Tubi. So whoever has Tubi, they can watch it there. And in a bunch more platforms that I'm not 100% sure of, it will give you the option when you Google it. So you can just, I'm sure there'll be something that people can pick the most convenient one for them. Roku channel as well, I think. So, you know, but Amazon, rent and buy on other places, YouTube and so on and so forth. That's where probably a lot of Sideworld will keep being. If you want to watch, our narrative films, our first film Hex, and then The Droving, which are kind of folk horror-y. One is period, one is modern day. They're both available on the same places, and I think now they're even free to watch on YouTube on one of them, their film channel networks.
I've actually got Hex pulled up on my Amazon, but if I can watch it on YouTube, I'm going to go do that, because there are commercials in that one.
The Amazon one. I guess it's on their new thing, Freevee. Yeah, I think that's the one that has like the commercials in it. But you can pick the one without the commercials.
I can't imagine the commercials are going to help the narrative any. So
no. They maybe pay our distributor more. I don't know, but it doesn't matter. Watch it the way it should be watched, and
exactly,
it will be fine.
Exactly. And then when you start to sell the original artwork, is that going to be on your website?
That's a good question. That's something that we're working on at the moment. As soon as we finish our next sidewall, which we're really getting ready to have done for Halloween. So the idea is that by Halloween we'll have Sidewalled as a sort of like our full horror documentary little franchise and series, and will be a full set of three, and we're going to be marketing and talking about that one. And at the same time, we'll start opening our Sidewalled store, which hopefully will have like people stuff that they're just in those areas they'll be interested in, because I sometimes want to buy like a little folklore-y mug that has like a cool creature on it, but I rarely can get to find stuff like that. But we'll have some merch stuff and things like that. But at the same time, I'm just excited to have some original, quite artistic things that people will enjoy as something that adds to the series and that can make people happy and make feel like it's a bit of a safe space for all of us fans for all that kind of stuff, and bring everybody together. History, horror, fairy tales, folklore, those things are so connected that I think people will enjoy if it's kind of all under one hub. And that includes also our artwork, so I'm sure we'll have many prints that everybody can own. It shouldn't be just like, oh, whoever has the money to buy the original only they have to have it. Like, we'll make something quite accessible to everyone.
Right.
On top of that, if you want to own the original, maybe we can talk about that. But it will be, I'm sure, we'll try to make it as inclusive as possible.
Great. So before we kind of wrap up here, is there anything else that you want to share with your audience or your potential audience?
Well, I mean, to our audience up until now, for the two films that have come out, and also counting Hex and the Drawing, if you're a longtime Rubicon fan, if you exist, I mean, I know that there is a few that do exist. Thank you very much, and I hope we're not disappointing with what we're making, and everybody up until now with those two films. No, thank you very much for buying into what we're trying to do, and I think in the beginning, that specific way of making a documentary and going for something that has a bit more of a kind of an artistic touch to it, but at the same time, it's still very approachable and accessible for a newcomer into the audience. That's very important to us. Thank you. We're receiving messages from all around the world, and just, you know, sometimes it's someone. We had a guy from Texas saying, I don't know. Yeah, I think he was talking about forests. And it's like, I don't know where this woods is. And I've never heard of it before, but I've seen this documentary five times now, when I want to go and visit the UK. So to me, that was very important. I mean, I'm not born in the UK. I'm born in Bulgaria. To me, it was important that those films, as local as they are, they introduce these stories to the whole world. And that's why it's important to me that at some point we'll get to that level where we get to go around the whole world and help the folklore stories from any country.
Yep.
And especially the ones who are probably even more underserved than the UK is. And,
right,
and
right.
There's a lot of stories to be told. And if, like I say, if you enjoy our stuff and want to support us, just, yeah, keep telling us to keep getting up in the morning and make more. And we will try to add to this little legacy and hopefully uncover more of that stuff, because I don't see too many people that really are doing it in the way that they try to spread that. And I think together we can do it.
Well, I think that I will be your first vote for keep getting up in the morning and doing it, because
thank you very much.
Both of them really enjoyable, and I'm really looking forward to seeing Hex. Again, thanks for taking the time. Thanks for having a conversation about it. I think that this is, like you said, something that is not typically being done. So it's a great adventure. It has been for me.
Well, thank you very much, Tracy. That's really helpful. And we'll keep going at it. And then, like I said, soon we'll be announcing what the third Sidewalled will be, what the theme will be.
Okay.
And we'll have it ready for Halloween, and we're going to have like a big Sidewalled Halloween push. And if you want to help us in any way, Don't worry about anything else, but just spreading the word, telling your friends if there's anyone who are fans of any of those things, you know, horror stories, history, folklore. That's what's going to help us and keep getting bigger and making more of these and making them more ambitious, going to more ambitious places. So we appreciate that in this day and age, in the information and letting people know is everything. But if you're the kind of person that complains that it's like, oh, everything I watch these days, they don't have this thing for me doesn't exist. And if what we're making is for you, that will help us continue.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much.
My thanks to George for coming back onto the podcast and to Tracy for conducting the interview. If you're listening to this episode around about the time that it comes out, then this is the close of Season 7 of the Folklore Podcast. Thanks for joining us, both on this episode and on any others that you may have listened to, and especially those of you that have been with us since Season 1 back in 2016. It's great to have you still here. If you celebrate it, have a happy and peaceful Christmas and New Year, and I'll look forward to joining you again in January for the start of Season 8 of the Folklore Podcast. See you next year.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.